If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
Today is Friday. It's November 18th, 2016. I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast, portions of which you can hear on my Saturday afternoon show at 1:30 on WGN.
I'm Eric Zorn, the controversial columnist for the Tribune. I run Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays.
And I'm Kristen McQuarrie, a member of the Tribune editorial board and occasional columnist.
Including this week.
Controversial columnist. Also.
Very highly disliked.
That has to be your stock in trade. You're not any good if everybody likes you. Trust me, I've discovered that over 30 years in radio. Our Steve Bertrand is not with us today. He's off on a remote broadcast with Bill and Wendy from WGN, and so here we go. A budget meeting was set for Monday of this week between the governor and legislative leaders. House Speaker Mike Madigan, Senate President John Cullerton didn't show up on Monday. The next day they did for what Kristen McQuarrie described as an unproductive meeting. About their inability to get to the first one, McQuarrie wrote, "What could be more important to Madigan and Cullerton than trying to resolve a budget impasse that's harming Illinois citizens? Their hubris. That's what." And in a column today, Eric, you noted that in Illinois, fixed expenses have been outpacing revenue by an estimated $30 million a day. You also point out that the state's backlog of unpaid bills, $10.7 billion, will hit $13.5 by next summer and top $20 billion by the summer of 2018. Okay, Kristen, so what should we take away from all of this?
Sort of business as usual in Illinois,
yeah,
unfortunately.
I know.
There are some more. They were supposed to get together Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday for veto session, where they're supposed to consider bills that were vetoed over the summer. They haven't been together since the beginning of June. Everyone went home to campaign thinking, all right, when we come back, elections are over, we'll bury the hatchet, we'll all get together and figure this out. And of course, the Democratic leaders, in my opinion, just continue to act like children, and they can't even make it to the first meeting. And then at the second meeting, Madigan was trying to change the rules a little bit and brought a fellow lawmaker to try to negotiate on his behalf. It just looks like more of the same.
Was that absence the first day, them just kind of showing the flag? We're just going to walk around here, let you know we're here, but we're not going to go in as a power play.
I never did figure out why they couldn't go on Monday. There was some scheduling conflict. It's like Bob Dylan has a scheduling conflict. For the Nobel Prize ceremony.
Like, I really want to know.
What is more important than this? And I agree with Kristen's question. Like, what were they doing on Monday that they couldn't make this meeting? How important was this lunch date they had?
Yeah, no kidding. But By the way, Eric, I did look up Bob Dylan's schedule, and he does not have a concert scheduled that date, so I'm not sure if he's going to be washing his cat or whatever, but it better be pretty good.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, as Kristen pointed out, there was some thought that after the campaign season was over and after all the finger-pointing and the recriminations and the you're a crook, no, you're a crook kind of thing, it was over. And we were in this veto session where there are a number of lame ducks. Now, how many? Not that many. But there are certainly some who maybe we would see some movement towards something. And it doesn't look like that's going to happen. And you know, there are a bunch of things to talk about with this election result. As people may know, in the House, where there's 118 seats, the Democrats lost 4 seats. The Republicans won 4 seats. However, you put a net pickup of 4. It's a net pickup of 4. In the Senate, the Democrats, where there is 59 seats in the Senate, and the Republicans picked up 2 seats after all is said and done. So there was some movement back toward the middle, but not enough to change. There's a supermajority still in the Senate. There's still a pretty strong majority of Democrats in the House. The Democrats have 67 to, what's the math?
I know that they still have like a 21 seat advantage over Republicans.
Significant advantage. So anyway, they've come back, and we have these figures that you talked about. This, you know, we're spending, I think it's $33 million a day more than we're taking in. And this, so these, the bills and the pension debt. Did you mention that how the pension debt is now going to be basically $130 billion? Mm-hmm. We've been saying $100 billion, $110 billion for a while. Now we're, the report came out and it's actually $130 billion. So we've got all these problems. And the first thing on the plate is we've got to have a budget, because we haven't had a budget since July 1st of 2015.
A year-long budget. We're kind of just scraping along here. We have a stopgap budget that ends. Eric is throwing around numbers. We do too. I do all the time. But I cannot emphasize enough that when we talk about a budget, we're not just talking about numbers on paper and we want to see, you know, spending and revenue match up, because that's just the way, I mean, it is supposed to be that way via the Constitution. But these are promises in the budget that are made to nonprofit organizations and elderly people and the disabled population, everybody who relies on the state for government. There is a promise made to them in the pages of these budgets. That's why it is important to pass a balanced budget, because all these people are waiting. Or what the Democrats continue to do, you pass a budget that's way out of balance, knowing that you are not going to have the money to pay for the promises that are within those pages. So that is why it's urgent, and that's why people like me go a little bananas about the fact that they can't manage to do this.
And where Kristen and I differ is I think that, I mean, the governor has a 44-point turnaround agenda. He's got all these reforms that he wants to enact, or changes in the law. I don't really care for the word reform. He's got these changes in the law that he wants to enact. And these are outside the budget process. They're things like he wants term limits, he wants redistricting reform, things like he wants workers. His top item now, I think, is workers' compensation reform, changes that he wants to implement. He's holding out for some of these before he agrees to sit down and hammer out taxes and spending with the Democrats. He's using that as leverage. I think it is past time for him to sort of set those aside. And I know it's getting rid of some of whatever leverage he has, but that leverage he has is just being twisted onto the very people that Kristen was just talking about. You know, the elderly, the disabled, the developmentally challenged, and so on. It's just time for them to say, okay, we will deal with workers' compensation law. We will deal with redistricting. We'll deal with term limits. We will deal with property tax freezes, all the things that are sort of top on this list after we do this budget. But if
you think they'll do that?
Well,
trust Madigan and Cullerton.
The Democrats have to
do that.
The Democrats have to agree to. To entertain
they
these
haven't for
bills.
2 years. They won't even give it a vote.
The problem is that Rauner is set up. Because I think he doesn't really know how this works. The idea of horse trading in budget negotiations is certainly common, but what's not common, and what they did here, when they backed the Democrats into a corner, saying we will not do this until you give in on some points on this of Rauner's agenda. And it's basically hostage taking. And if the Democrats agree, like, okay, now, okay, because you've twisted our arm, we're going to go along with these three items that you want. And then, so what stops them next year from saying, okay, now you gave me those three items. Now,
he was elected to reform government. And these are not reforms that the Democrats wholly oppose, like workers' comp. You say he has a 44-point turnaround agenda. He did. Now it's down to about three or four items. Do you even know what those are and specifically what they would do?
I know it's property tax. Tax freeze, workers' compensation.
What does workers' compensation reform mean? What does he want to do?
Well, he wants to lower the causation, right? He wants to change the standard of when an injury is compensable for a worker, as I understand it. I don't think there's not actually a.
There are six pieces of legislation, and the one that he wants, it is a tinkering around the edges that Democrats have heard from their small business owners, too, that they need this because the insurance costs that they're paying are much higher in this state than in other states. And it simply states it sets a causation standard. You have to have a higher standard to prove that your injury occurred on the job. And I just spoke to a business owner last week who hired someone who 2 weeks out of the job claimed he got a hernia while working in this construction industry. And the construction industry is what we're mostly talking about here. He never had to prove that the injury actually occurred on the job. They found out later that he had this injury previously, and it was on his medical records, but we don't have a standard that allows employers to use that kind of information. This dragged on for 3 years. years. The company had to continue to pay him disability and being off work time and legal fees and everything else. And I think they ended up having to pay, you know, most of his medical costs, all because we don't have this same standard. So what does that small business owner do the next time he wants to hire someone? The reason I'm going into this is because I don't feel like these issues really get talked about. People in the media throw out this is anti-union, this is anti-business, when really, if you dig into it and you talk to people who are affected by this, Democrats would get on board with a causation standard. It is the leadership that is beholden to the trial lawyers who make a lot of money off of these medical settlements who won't allow a vote on the floor.
I'm not going to disagree with you on this. You're clearly more schooled in workers' comp.
And prevailing wage, which is another thing he wants to talk about that everybody says is anti-union. But when you actually dig into it and you talk to mayors and how their hands are tied when they're trying to negotiate with their own unions, the tinkering around the edges that Rauner wants to implement to allow mayors, Democratic mayors, Republican mayors, whatever, all over the state, a little more room to negotiate things like hours, like how many hours their employees should be working, which they're not allowed to do now because Illinois labor laws are so heavily balanced to the unions over the employers. All of this stuff is actually not that radical, but you believe the Democratic talking points, you would think that Rauner is out there trying to bust the unions.
I think he is out to bust the unions. I think philosophically he's very much opposed to the unions. But beyond that, I have looked into the prevailing wage thing, and I've looked at states where they have gotten rid of it, and they've gotten, you know, there's not that much of a benefit to the state's economy. This is like, you know, that's one issue. I think it's one that's worth talking about. The workers' compensation stuff is another one, but I think it's an important thing to look at. Like I said, you've studied this a lot more than I have. I've got gathered a bunch of string on it. I'm not sure of it, but it does need to be considered. I think not in the context of this hostage negotiation.
Why do you keep using the word hostage? That's what the Democrats call it. It's not hostage. Rauner was elected by a majority of the people in Illinois to implement a lot of these things, to allow a vote on term limits and redistricting reform. And if Rauner just, what they basically want him to do is agree to an unbalanced budget with a big tax hike and then trust that these two guys in charge are going to take up these other issues. Why in the world would he give in to that? And by the way, budget negotiations over the past 25 years always include non-budget items. We built a new stadium for the Chicago Bears. We rejiggered the Chicago Park District makes up its board. I mean, the negotiations always include stuff that is outside the realm of the little piece of paper that the budget is.
But never
on.
In the context of an ultimatum. That's where Rauner is inexperienced.
Why are you using the word ultimatum?
Because it is. He won't sit down and do a budget. Rauner has never given them. John is in there going, "What am I started here?"
I know. I'm sorry, John. Rauner
came out and said he's not going to do what the Constitution demands that he do, which is like give us.
The legislature hasn't passed a balanced budget in a decade.
Well, what I'm saying is the Constitution requires the governor to submit to the General Assembly a budget proposal in which revenues and expenditures balance.
He's done that twice, Eric. I know that this is a point of contention with you, and you won't go on the first budget that he introduced in 2015 was predicated on some savings that he was anticipating from pension reform before the Supreme Court changed the law. Then the Supreme Court said you can't have pension reform, so that, yes, that did throw his budget into a tizzy because he introduced it in February and the decision came out in May. And then the next year he introduced two different versions of budgets. I sat through those hearings. One included it did include a big hole, because this was the hole that if we can agree on a tax increase, the tax increase will fill this little hole. Here's the other budget that will be actually matching revenues, and it will include lots and lots of cuts. So I don't know why we keep going down this path.
It's pixie dust, though. His balanced budget.
So what else do you have? What else you got? The legislature has passed unbalanced budgets for as long as I've been covering Springfield.
Well, I guess realistically, we all know that Mike Madigan does not want to vote for a tax increase. He doesn't want to put his entire caucus behind a tax increase, a unilateral. He wants
Why
it to
not?
Be bipartisan. He wants
Why?
It, because he knows that the next election cycle he'll get attacked.
They didn't lose a single seat in 2011 when they passed the income tax. They gained seats. The Democrats picked up seats after a 67% largest income tax increase passed without a single Republican vote in 2011. Again, like, why do you keep buying into these arguments? Challenge them. Why not? You have a supermajority. Why do you insist on getting Republicans on board? Do it.
Well, they don't have a supermajority anymore.
Well, they don't.
No, but Eric, do you see the point? Why doesn't Mike Madigan, for once, just a show of faith? Why couldn't he lead the Democrats to meet the governor on some of these what sound like relatively small points to me with Kristen? Couldn't he just say, look, guys, we'll survive this. Let's give them these two or three points.
I think he should have. I mean, I think that this all should have been done before the negotiations got to the point where they are now. Right now, they're both in their corners. You know, it's like, who's going to surrender? Who's going to give up?
And the budgets
neither side has left themselves an out here, which is a big problem, because you've got them both dug in. You know, there's no way for Rauner to go forward without everyone saying he surrendered. There's no way for Madigan to give in without saying people that he caved. These guys clearly don't like each other in this campaign. Was fairly ugly.
But so you think their egos are as much on the line here as anything?
I think, yeah. I mean, I don't know, Kristen, you think there's any ego involved here at all? I mean, yeah. I think
that's pretty spectacular. We all laugh about that because we know the answer to it. But it's pretty amazing. Like you said in your article, your column, Kristen, the hubris of it all. Their feelings are coming before, my God, billions of dollars of services and taxes. It's insane, to me.
I mean, my thought is that they ought to get a commitment. Madigan ought to give them a commitment. Madigan and Cullerton, the Democratic leaders, ought to give Rauner a commitment. We will take to the floor a proposal on the five elements. I'm not sure that prevailing wage is among his top five anymore. I don't know. Those keep shifting. We'll take five of them and we'll put them on the floor for an up or down vote, and that might mean a term limit referendum, and it'd be very hard for Democrats to vote against term limits given how popular they are. It'd be pretty hard for them to vote against redistricting given how popular they are. But they've got to at least nod to the Democratic process, I think. I mean, that would be my solution to them. It's like a pledge from them. We will put these on the floor. We're not going to bottle them up in committee. We're going to open them for a vote.
Well, one last question about all of this.
That's all he's asked for 2 years.
He wants them to be passed.
No. At part, the constitutional amendment questions, the redistricting and the term limits, all he asked for was a vote on the floor. That's it. He's not asking. They're going to pass. He doesn't need to round up votes for that. He just asked for a commitment that they would call him for a vote, and they didn't. And you have Madigan's attorney running around and single-handedly blocking redistricting reform. So I don't see where you think there's like this trust issue that Rauner should just give in to these two guys who have no agenda, apparently, and have not given on anything. I mean,
they're going to.
Here's my question. Is this budget conversation we're having about a balanced budget or a budget for 2017, or are we also addressing the deficit that the state's built up, the billions of dollars, et cetera? Is it, you know, are we just trying to, is this conversation about paying off those old debts that we have and addressing the pension problem, or is it just kind of, you know, year-to-year stuff that we're talking about?
It's so hard to keep all the debt straight, John.
Yeah, I know.
It's amazing to me.
Yeah.
We have $10 billion in bills that are piling up. No other state has that. I mean, every other state, I'm sure yours, John, you have like a 30-day cycle. Somebody submits a bill to the state because they provided such and such service. The state writes them a check. We have $10 billion in asks in being a deadbeat. And this has been going on for years.
And some of these people, like I've talked to a friend of mine who's an accountant, and as I understand it, it's like if you're an electrician and you did some work for the state, you might not get that check for a year. Imagine that. You have to float the state, your staff, your labor, your materials, because the state just doesn't pay in a timely fashion. Who wants to do business with somebody like that? You wouldn't. It's pretty amazing.
Well, and of course, our borrowing costs go up, too. I mean, our bond rating goes down, our borrowing costs go up, and now the investment returns on the pension funds aren't what they were hoping for, so these pension funds are needing more money to keep themselves at least on some sort of a ramp towards some sort of solvency.
Here's the solution. A bigger soda tax. Lost in all the election talk was Cook County's decision to impose a penny per ounce on sugary drinks. So your 75-cent can of pop, if you can find one, is now 87 cents and so on. It's interesting to note that Chicago already has a tax, a retail sales tax on soft drinks in cans and bottles, and on wholesale syrups if you're getting a fountain drink. But now they're going to tax per ounce sugary drinks in Cook County. This is a tax to discourage you from eating too much sugar and to generate $75 million a year. I know about sin taxes, but they keep adding more sins to the list. Are you guys okay with this revenue generation means? You don't have to drink sugary drinks.
I think that Kristen and I will probably agree on this. I'm certainly not okay with it. I think it's regressive, and I think that the health excuse is kind of phony given all the beverages that are covered by it. I don't like it.
And Eric drinks Diet Snapple.
I have one with me right here.
As soon as he figured out that even artificially sweetened drinks were going to be impacted, you know, that
when it was,
changed his mind.
When it was regular Snapple, I was fine. I was totally fine.
You can always avoid paying the tax. I mean, that's where I fall on these things sometimes. You know, like if it's on cigarettes or beer or other things like that, I think, well, I don't have to drink or smoke. Maybe I could drive less if it was a gas tax. You know, there's ways to avoid paying taxes. Sugary drinks ought to be one that you could not pay if you don't want to pay it. But they're going to get $75 million a year for Cook County, and they say they need that money. So I don't know how else they're supposed to do it. I guess cut costs more. I'm not sure that it works out that way. But if you're going to raise taxes, I do like voluntary taxes, guys.
Why don't they just have the nerve? I think our editorial said this. Why don't they just have the nerve to charge the taxes that they want to everybody, to try to
right.
get everybody, rather than to try to pick off little groups of people? You know, I'm not big on that strategy. I think that they should. You know, if they need this tax revenue, they can make the case for it. Then they need to find the places where it's fairly and evenly distributed the burden. So,
let's move on to the national scene. This is the topic that we've started with every podcast for the last year or so. Donald Trump has selected retired Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn as his national security advisor. Jeff Sessions will be attorney general, it looks like. He's also picked Mike Pompeo, the Republican lawmaker from Kansas, to lead the CIA. Reince Priebus will be chief of staff. Steve Bannon will be hanging out with the gang. The USA Today says Pompeo's appointment could help the Trump team counter a narrative that's begun to develop in the past few days that the president-elect is valuing loyalty over qualifications in filling his administration posts. Eric, you go first. What stands out to you in the last week as Trump tries to assemble his team?
Well, Bannon jumps out at me as being really an inappropriate choice, given his leadership role in Breitbart, which is a pretty disgusting alt-right news site. Another thing that jumps out at me from all this is the, and you didn't mention this, but Mitt Romney is apparently coming in for a meeting, and he may be apparently to be in line for Secretary of State, which is very interesting considering how much Mitt Romney had bashed Trump during the campaign. It called him a phony, a fraud, ignorant, he was like looking over my shoulder, I think, when I was writing my columns. And that strikes me as a very interesting outreach to really, I mean, Mitt Romney is sort of a moderate Republican, the sensible voice. I've said this a lot of times, people. If Mitt Romney had been elected in 2012 when he ran against Obama, I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't have liked it, but I wouldn't have had a fit like I had over Trump. So, I mean, that seems like it's something that's promising. I mean, it's a mixed bag. This whole set of people is a mixed bag. There's a really, really anti-immigrant cast of the people whose names seem to be at the top of this list. And there's sort of an erratic foreign policy that General Flynn, you know, he's all about dropping bombs and cozying up to Russia and that kind of stuff. So, Kristen.
And the role that Trump's son-in-law is playing is just kind of weird. I mean, I don't have to know who all these people are, but you talk about the government of the United States of America and the people that are cobbling it together as this cast of Trump family and friends, and it's every bit as strange in a way as the campaign was.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with him using his son-in-law as a sounding board or an advisor, but if the Trump family takes up actual payroll on the dime type positions within the White House, I would have the same problems that I do with all of the nepotism here in Cook County. You know, it's not right, and it complicates things when you expect your employees to be reporting to your son-in-law. I don't like that. And as for the other cabinet members, I'm really just kind of holding off yet. I don't know. I don't know what I think of Jeff Sessions.
Mm-hmm.
I did a little research on Bannon. I don't think Breitbart is all or nothing. The alt-right opinion pieces that they have let run on the site are really you know, they're offensive and wrong. But I don't know that I could say that every single day, every single article on Breitbart is you know, offensive or wrong. I just keep seeing this stuff with Bannon, and then they run like, here are six headlines that have appeared on Breitbart. Well, you know what? If you ran six headlines from the Chicago Tribune, then you tried to tag it all on Bruce Dold, I don't know that that's a complete enough picture. But I'm gonna hold out forming an opinion on him too. I've read a lot that he is actually more reasonable than people are saying, but I don't know.
I struggle with that.
It does seem to me that the son-in-law is going to be playing the same sort of role maybe that Valerie Jarrett played in the Obama White House, which is sort of an advisor, an official consigliere type who he trusts, the president trusts absolutely. And, you know, and Kushner is apparently a fairly moderate political voice that he is. He's not.
And Jewish, if that matters to anybody.
Yeah, he's Orthodox Jew, and I guess Ivanka has converted also. But mm-hmm. but he's not. He's someone who's fairly canny and cautious as opposed to. And he was perhaps the one, along with Kellyanne Conway, his campaign manager there in the last part of the campaign. Those are the people who were sort of keeping him somewhat reined in, which is, I think, has something to do with why he ended up winning the election. That in the last 3 or 4 weeks, he kind of went quiet in terms of making a lot of news. And that really helped him, because every time he did, the Republicans started coming back home to him. I think Kristen is right to take a step back and say, look, this is a transition period. He's not even president yet. Let's wait and see the kind of cabinet that he assembles, who's going to be in it, what we know about them. And again, you know, some of these things come out. Jeff Sessions, apparently in the 80s, he couldn't get confirmed for a federal judgeship because of some racially
awful
tinged
things he said.
Comments that he made. Now, do we hold that against him 30, 35 years later? What has his record been since then? I haven't paid a ton of attention to Jeff Sessions, I'll be honest. I don't know.
He's pretty right conservative, and some of the quotes that I've seen, you know, where he called the NAACP and some of these other groups un-American, you know, do we really want somebody like that as our attorney general? I don't know.
It doesn't take 60 votes anymore, am I right about that, to confirm that
the... I don't know the answer to that.
I'm not sure. I know that the Democrats weakened the filibuster in order to get some lower level judicial appointments through. Correct?
I do not know the answer to that.
I think that's right. But so and there was a statement. I thought this was actually one of the bigger news events of the week. Was Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, said that he was not going to get rid of the filibuster for everything. That he was not. I mean, the so-called nuclear option that the Democrats always played with when they had the majority, and the Republicans have played with when they have the majority. Because every time there's a narrow majority from one party to the other in the Senate, they think about, oh, if only we could pass, you know, just a simple majority, we would be able to do so much. But there's this fear that both parties have, which is that as soon as we get rid of the filibuster, then we're going to be this nation where every election swings, and then legislation gets all enacted, and it all gets repealed the next time, and it doesn't lend any the sort of continuity that mm-hmm. is important mm-hmm. for life. So I thought it was really interesting that McConnell basically said, no, they're not going to get rid of the filibuster. And that means, and I think it's a good sign for things like Supreme Court nominations. When Trump nominates people to the Supreme Court, he's going to have to put somebody in there who's not Ted Cruz, for instance. I mean, he's got to put these. I mean, seriously, I heard that name mentioned.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a moderating force, and some of these cabinet positions. I don't know the answer if he needs.
It's funny how they all come home. I mean, even Ted Cruz or say Mitt Romney. Isn't it a quandary for Mitt Romney because Trump said terrible things about Romney. Romney said terrible things about President-elect Trump. But then if you have the opportunity to serve the administration, maybe you do so because that's an almost higher calling. It's not to help Donald Trump out, but it's to help the American people from a Donald Trump, their duly elected president. So then you say, all right, I know this looks like I'm a hypocrite, but maybe that's, you know, the better choice for a Mitt Romney. It's also been interesting to me this week to watch Trump still late night sober tweeting, you know, punctuated with exclamation points at 3, 4, 5 in the morning. He's still blasting the New York Times and Democrats about his process of picking a cabinet this week. He tweeted, quote, "I am the only one who knows who the finalists are," exclamation point, as if it were a game show, you know?
Is he still sober? I'm thinking, and I know you didn't mean sober in that context.
I kind of do. He sober tweets the way people drunk tweet. You look at their feed, and it's 3 in the morning, and they're saying crazy stuff with exclamation points. But there's been no discussion about his weird late-night tweeting, except that it's weird late-night tweeting. It's never been attributed to anything else except his own super defensiveness. So then he's this week tweeting, quote, "I worked hard with Bill Ford to keep the Lincoln plant in Kentucky. I owed it to the great state of Kentucky for their confidence in me." Like a king, you know, with these sort of dictates, when in fact he wasn't the decider on this. The Washington Post headlined the story, "Trump just took credit for stopping Ford from moving a plant to Mexico, but it wasn't planning to." And at the end of that story, they wrote, "Trump appeared to be relying on information gleaned from an article posted on a website of a shop that sells business cards and door hangers." So, you know, that's just their little dig, right? But, I mean, you know, Ford did say that, all right, we'll keep the production here. They're still going to move production from Michigan to Mexico. So I don't know really what Donald Trump has accomplished, but he's, you know, crowing that he got Ford to do something and that's his way of thanking Kentucky for their support.
This issue of fake news is a big one and how to deal with it. There, if you look in your Tribune this weekend, I anticipate there's going to be an editorial about that that would be worth reading, as they all are for the most part. But yeah, it would be good. I think, and he's going to lose his iPhone when he gets to the
somebody needs
office.
To take it. Ivanka, if you're listening, and I think she does subscribe
sure.
to this podcast, Ivanka, take it away from your dad.
Yes.
Or tell your husband to, because he'll have a press secretary. All this stuff that he's doing at 4 a.m, there's a person whose job it is to do that stuff better than you are, Donald Trump. Let them do their job. And that's the end of the podcast. Okay, let's conclude with our recommendations for the week, something we are reading, watching, listening to, or consuming that we think you might enjoy. I'll go first. I've gone back to comfort. You know how, like, you go back to comfort foods in times of stress? I've gone back to a comfort book for me. It's Bill Bryson's Short History of Nearly Everything. I think I've recommended that 3 times, but it's just a delightful, sometimes funny, fascinating, and understandable description of everything from protons to planets and how the world came to be and works. It's Bill Bryson's Short History of Nearly Everything. Nary a whiff of politics in it. It's very pleasant to read through. So that's my recommendation.
Mine, I have started recording with my DVR since I am asleep at the time. Seth Meyers' opening monologue. Was it The Late Show? I don't even know what it's called. But Seth Meyers, he follows Jimmy Fallon, whom I don't really care for, the Tonight Show host. But his monologues are very sharp. And he's the guy who used to host the Saturday Night Live news event, and his
weekend update, yeah.
Yeah, and he does this thing, A Closer Look. It's kind of got a little bit of the John Oliver thing happening. Very funny. And so what I do is I record that, and then I watch it in the morning. So
yeah, that's getting better. His whole show's getting better. And I don't watch him either, Eric, but I, like you, in the next morning will see things that are trending. And I've been finding myself watching some of his stuff more now than I used to. He's kind of getting his feet underneath him, I think. How about you, Kristen?
I have a very quick and easy Christmas cookie recipe. Yay!
Yay!
My daughter has gotten into baking a little bit. Okay, go buy the in-the-tube sugar cookies. Get some vanilla frosting. You can make it or buy it. Add a tiny bit of food coloring to make it pink. Spread it on the cookies after they're cooked. Crush up some peppermints, like the peppermint patties. Not peppermint patties, the hard candy.
Candy canes?
Yeah, or candy canes. Yeah. Add a little bit of cinnamon and sprinkle those on top of the cookies. That it will all kind of harden, and they're just delicious. There you go.
Do you bake it first? You mean you put that
you
stuff on before?
You bake the cookie.
You bake it first, and then you put the stuff
and
on.
And then you put
then
the
you
stuff
ice
on.
It, then you put the sprinkles on top.
Yep, just really easy festive cookie. There you go.
Christmas cookies. And that's this week's podcast. Thank you, Kristen McQuarrie, Eric Zorn. You can find them in the Chicago Tribune. Steve Bertrand may well join us next week. He's part of the Mincing Rascals podcast. Our producer is Kristen Decker. She engineered the show today, too. Thank you, Kristen Decker. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNplus.com. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus podcast network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 1:30 to 2 p.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.
You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you!